Hello and welcome to Compulsive Reader Talks. I'm Magdalena Ball, and today's guest, Kent Carter, is publisher of Cordite Books and managing editor of the wonderful Cordite Poetry Review. He's author of four poetry collections, In the Hungry Middle of Here, published in 2009, Sputnik's Cousin in 2014, and California Suite 2018, as well as Fat Chance, just published by Upswell. He's also editor of Joyful Strains, Making Australia Home, which we spoke about in 2013 with Ali Lemer. And it is an absolute pleasure to have you back again, Kent. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Magdalena. It's really great to be back here, and I appreciate your interest in me and the book.
Yes, it's really quite an extraordinary book, and I'm looking forward to getting into the meat of it. Can I ask you just to please open with a poem? Just to give people who are listening who haven't yet purchased the book a sense and a flavor for, you know, what they're getting into.
Okay, great. I'm going to read an excerpt from one of the four sections in the book, and that section is called Fat Chance, and there's a number of subsections within that. So I'm going to read one of those. I guess a little bit about this section, I won't say too much initially, is that it focuses on sole survivors of major airline crashes. And so here is an initial excerpt. 16 August 1987. Cecilia Chacon was recovered in her assigned seat. It was intact, unburnt, and upright in the middle of Interstate 94. She was alert, conscious, still buckled and clutching World Traveler, Northwest Airlines in-flight magazine in her hands. Cecilia's flight lifted off the runway at 170 knots and began rolling from side to side at just under 15 meters above Detroit Metropolitan Wayne County Airport, Michigan. Both of the jet's engines stalled, causing the aircraft to spiral 40 degrees to the port side and bisect a floodlight pole near the end of the runway. This removed 6 meters of the port wing and ignited an internal jet fuel tank. The aircraft then counter-rotated 90 degrees with its starboard wing penetrating the roof of an Avis car hire building and a display of Ford Bronco II SUVs. This action severed an equal length of outer starboard wing, igniting it by the same means. With that counterforce, the aircraft inverted a full 180 degrees and flew 2 kilometers upside down above Middle Belt Road's evening traffic. Fire billowed from both ends of the severed wings. The aircraft cambered downwards onto the road, striking 2 vehicles and decapitating both drivers, although this did not arrest the inertia that the aircraft had achieved during full rotation. The aircraft rammed the support abutments of a railroad bridge spanning Middle Belt Road. This impact quartered the fuselage, further retarding its pace, and caused the quadrants to roll down the commuter beltway until they concurrently ricocheted off an Interstate 94 overpass. The remaining structural integrity collapsed into unrecognizable char. Dental records were ineffective in the casualty identification process. Cecilia Chacon was 4 years old. Of the 154 other passengers and crew, the largest piece of human remains was half a woman's palm with 3 fingers still attached. It was a DC-9-82 passenger jet.
Thank you for reading that.
Of course.
Which is both, you know, it's both, you know, absolutely absorbing and horrible. And I think feel bad book of the year. But tell me really, which is on the back blurb, by the way, what drew you? And I know you also have a little bit of overlap and a whole section in Sputnik's Cousin called Fat Chance as well. So what keeps drawing you back to these, you know, kind of real life stories of kind of horror and survival?
Well, the section that you noted in Sputnik's Cousin is much, much earlier versions of some of the work in Fat Chance, but I've expanded it significantly. And interestingly, the piece that I just read, that was an incident that happened Well, I was still living in the United States, and I actually remember that very clearly, as my grandfather was a retired pilot for the same airline. So it was a little bit of a big deal, and I remember that happening. And I've always remembered that, and the unbelievable uncanniness of survival in a situation where the next people weren't even close. And I thought about that for many years. And I guess in kind of in the way that people, or some people, and I've been guilty of this, can rubberneck at traffic accidents and this and that. I wanted to, first of all, find out, well, has that happened before? Has it happened again? And surprisingly, there's quite a few instances of sole survivors of major, major airline crashes. And so I got to thinking, with a bit of a self-experiment, given that my own writing style is nothing really like this book, if I could put together some factual information that reported on these sorts of flight incidents in such a cold and antiseptic way to remove any sort of florid language, any sort of embellishment, any sort of commentary on me, the author, to present people with a scaffolding of facts and almost kind of force them to look at it in a bit of a sick and twisted sort of way, but people do seem to be drawn to it. But in so doing, kind of forcing them to feel uncomfortable emotions. When I've read some of these in public, some people will nervously giggle or laugh. Other people look a bit horrified. Some people sit silently, but everybody seems to be gripped by it. And that was kind of my intent, to force people to fill in the blanks of their own emotions and kind of acknowledge this built environment that humans have created for ourselves, but also the extreme dangers that exist therein. So I thought about that for a number of years. And while I was collecting stories of these sole survivors of airline crashes, I wanted to offset each one with a tale, another factual tale of perhaps a more ignominious way to expire, not necessarily in a Darwin Award sort of way, but to further make commentary on, you know, contemporary Western, not necessarily Western, but it turns out most of them are, life experiences and how those interact. So that's kind of the gist of it. And throughout that process, I dubbed the term journalism poetry, which it's kind of neither here nor there. I hadn't really seen that term used before, but that's really exactly what I was doing, an extensive amount of research and then distilling the words down as much as I possibly could just to the cold, hard facts, and then allowing the reader to take control of the emotion, whether they wanted to or not.
Yes, because you put us in the kind of unwilling role of voyeur, of rubbernecker. And, you know, and yes, we might have secretly, I mean, I think it's almost impossible. Let me just confess. It's almost impossible to read the book, I think, and not do a little Googling along with it to go, what actually happened to this person? Yeah. You know, are they still alive? What are they doing now? And, you know, that there's a kind of connective tissue to, and this is, I think, what you're doing deliberately, of course, between, you know, this real life and then, you know, the text and the way in which the reader works through those things.
Yeah, and that was my research process. I mean, I didn't go to the national archives of each country and look up things. I used what I could find online. And for some of these instances, there is a bit of information. There's the most famous case near the end of this section about the woman in Peru or South America, which I believe it was Vanna Herzog even did a movie about. So that one's more famous. But others, there's very limited information. And most of that information was in English, but not all. So there were some things in Arabic and Middle Eastern that I just flatly couldn't read. I tried to get some translations of that, but it was mostly about me doing research online. And there is finite amounts. So none of those are Google proof. The information is kind of all there. This section of the book is the only one that is probably just pure straight nonfiction. It is all true based on what I could research and find. So there's kind of that slippage of how much faith do we trust in the reality of the internet, of facts, of reporting, you know, so it opens up a lot of questions, I think, but
yeah. But you do put little things at the, so like you sometimes put little juxtapositions. Like I know it is trying to appear very, unemotional, and it does come across that way. But this couple of poems where you have these little lines of, a related story at the bottom that really puts a gloss onto it, you know, that the deforestation or some environmental situation that might have given rise to, you know, a big snake being in the area or something.
Those were some of the final ones that I did, and there is I did include some facts, you know, which are overtly political or environmental. So that was by intent, but still, I'm leaving the association up for the reader to kind of connect the dots, and it's not particularly challenging to connect those dots. Some of the other poems in this section, such as the young woman who was the sole survivor of a crash in Cuba. You know, they had once again, plane was colliding with the ground, and they flew through a herd of cattle, specifically cattle, and then wrapped around railroad tracks, and she was the only one to survive. Now, at the very end of that poem, I note that when she got a surprise visit from a Cuban pop star, he brought her a plush toy of a cow. And so I thought those little kind of connections really were involved in all of these sole survivors. You know, it's not ironic. I don't actually know what that is, but I found those tidbits very interesting, you know, and about the chap in Indonesia who was swallowed whole by a snake, and his wife found out about his demise while eating snake beans. So I like those little nuances. And so I was willing to grant myself that. And they work in a little bit of a humorous way, but also just kind of a head-scratching, uncanny sort of way. And
how did it come to be that these facts? I think. Yes, the man who dissolves in sulfuric acid in the Yellowstone National Park.
I remember hearing about that one as well, because I was, I think at the time I was at university in Montana, or it was, I'm well familiar with Yellowstone Park, so I don't know the exact pot that he dissolved in, but there's thousands of them out there, and I know the dangers of it.
So I have to ask, before we move on to the next section, and before I get you to read another poem, I have to ask about Corn Dog. What is the significance of the Corn Dog bookends? Again, Corn Dog is funny, and it kind of, when you get to the second Corn Dog segment, it kind of changes the way you think about some of the rest of it, but I'm not sure why.
Yeah, look, I wanted to put in a reference that I know that you'll get because you're from New York. I wanted to put in just some bookends about extreme kind of greed and corpulence, kind of in a Boss Tweed sort of way. And so I thought I'd use this prize-winning pig, this hog, which very much was a real thing. It was at the Minnesota State Fair. And it just seemed to suit in nicely. It does seem a bit non sequitur, but it's about overabundance, I think, is my primary intent of that. And when you read what happens between it, and then, of course, Corn Dog dies. I just thought it was a very fitting bookend. And again, I'll let readers draw what they want in between the life and high times of this prized winning sow and its death. Maybe it got too fat. Maybe it got too big. Maybe it was overfed. So things like that.
Yes. Interesting. And I guess the whole book, really, to my mind, is about these, you know, these connections, these conversations, if you like, between the reader and the piece, and maybe all poetry is like this, but the reader and the piece and the pieces and one another, and the way in which they're structured and the way in which they sit, really gets you thinking about stuff. Well, again, maybe all poetry, good poetry does this, but, you know, about stuff that is mundane and yet totally extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. Agreed.
Yeah. So Gossy Paboma is the only section, which is, of course, a retained sponge, let's say, in the body. That's the only section of the book you actually have references for. And you call it a memoir. Talk to me a little bit. Are those your letters to Santa? What is the memoir aspect in that?
That piece is a bit of a bricolage, and it was the very last one I wrote, and I couldn't figure out how to do it for many, many, many years. But then I finally had this great Hosanna moment after a lovely weekend doing something or other, I can't remember, but I finally cottoned on what I was going to do. So I did write letters to Santa Claus. I definitely did that. So that is true, and it reflects that. A lot of what I say in the letters is also true. All those are real names, real facts, real things that I had, real desires that I wanted. But I wanted to try to create a bit of a metamorphosis with those facts. And again, we're getting back to want, greed, and capitalism. So the first letter is fairly straight ahead from a young boy's perspective. And then there's about five or six letters, I guess. So as it progresses, the metamorphosis is that I realize that I have actually been inside the bowels and guts of Santa Claus the whole time, this manifestation of greed and capitalism. But I also wanted to couch that against actual scientific facts. So yes, Gossi Poboma was a term derived from leaving sponges in people, but it also could be clamps, devices, tweezers, any number of things, rubber bands and straps that have been left inside patients in medical procedures. So I wanted to moor the piece in these cold, hard clinical facts. And yes, those are credited because I did use the lines verbatim, excerpted from scientific articles. So that one probably took the most research, or the most hardcore research in medical journals, I guess it was. And yeah, so that needed crediting. But altogether, whether it works or not, those pieces kind of created what the section Gossi Poboma is. Not sure if any at all that makes any sense or not, but
It
it did to
does.
me finally.
Yeah, it does. And I love the
Yeah.
idea of a memoir of the self as a gossip performer. It's again, it's kind
Yeah,
of
yeah.
Lynchian
It's a bit meta.
horror, but also pretty fun and wonderful. So I might get you to read something from that, if that's okay. Are you okay with reading, say, maybe the second one, 71, in which the fireworks?
70. What page was that on?
71. Yeah. So it's number two, Dear
Number
Santa, page 71.
two. Okay, yes. Dear Santa, an 84-year-old woman was admitted to a hospital with weakness, lethargy, and infectious secretions of the umbilicus. The patient had undergone hysterectomy 21 years before. The patient was a candidate for laparotomy, which revealed a long gauze attached to a band and a metal ring in the umbilicus and hypogastric regions, as well as a large abscess containing 200 milliliters of infectious secretions, severe adhesions of the intestines, and approximately a 1 centimeter fistula in the ileum due to the foreign body. Mom wants me to write you a thank you letter. I like N scale model trains now, but I also like HO. Dad made me a train set that fits into the bottom bunk of my bunk beds. Thank you for the Santa Fe engine and the coal cars. The coal cars say Santa Fe on them, and you can take out the coal that is plastic. I live in Santa Fe. They came from DeVargas Mall. Thank you for the Capsella and the Space Warp. The new mall is Villa Linda Mall on Rodeo Road. Graham and Gramp drove down this year with the old lawnmower in the trunk, but forgot the spark plug in the basement. One in every 1,000 to 1,500 intra-abdominal operations occurs at least once per year in hospitals where 8,000 to 18,000 surgeries are performed annually. We report a case of a foreign Espeto bulb in the vagina following a robot-assisted total laparoscopic hysterectomy. I got $20 from Grandma and I got 45s. I made a train tunnel from a plaster of Paris. I played Tarzan Boy by Baltimora and Break My Stride by Matthew Wilder and One Night in Bangkok by Murray Head and Puttin' on the Ritz by Taco and Let's Go All the Way by Sly Fox when I made the tunnel. And I like hearing them many times to hear new things when I hear them again. As soon as clinician saw her patient's CT scan, radiologist page Dr. Ann Dembitzer, an internist at the Veterans Affairs Hospital in Palo Alto, California. The Santa Fe derailed inside the model tunnel. I helped gather wood from the park plaza's green belt to start the fire on Christmas Eve. Pinyon pine smells good. We have new chimney and a Kiva fireplace with two nichos. The New Mexico chimney is bigger than the Minnesota chimney, and the bricks are new and yellow. You will be able to get down it quickly. I also got Lean on Me by Club Nouveau. The patient had consulted Dr. Dembitzer because of nausea and pain in his abdomen. This was the second clamp to be found inside the same patient. The first one, left after intestinal surgery, was found 8 months after the operation and removed by the same surgeon who had left it. It caused an infection that made the patient ill. The second clamp was left behind in the same operation as the first, but was somehow overlooked when the first was found. The patient would need yet another operation to take out the second clamp. Dad got me fireworks from Fort Sumner because it did not take up much room in his minivan. The Santa Fe derailed because I put five ladyfingers in the Bangor and Aristic potatoes boxcar behind the engine and lit the fuse with a match that I put in a glass of water and had the transformer on, and it was running, and that is where it exploded in the tunnel. The New Mexico chimney has a flue that is easy to open, and when you get there, you can do it. Like Dad told me about when he was a kid in Billings, I look up into the Xmas tree and I see all the lights and it looks like a city with people. And my friend Colin came down next year. Annie is my dog and she chases rabbits on the green belt but cannot catch them. I like the smell of burning. Three factors stood out. Compared patients who did not have objects left inside them, those who did were 9 times as likely to have emergency surgery. Disorganized action increases with complexity, making it harder to keep track of sponges and equipment. The third factor was size. People who were heavy were more likely to have objects left behind than lean people, simply because there is more room for things. At the top of the chimney, Dad took pictures of the cardboard cutout of the G-scale Burlington steam engine with a real sunset, so it was all black because I wanted to win the model railroader picture of the contest. Picture of the year contest, but we left the lens cap in the picture by accident, and we did not win because you could see it, and they said so. I cut paper smoke out from construction paper and taped it to the smokestack so it looked real. It was thick. The patient had two clamps left behind and suffered from pain, abscesses, and septic shock, and his lawyer said the infections and septic shock led to a stroke. The original operation in which the instruments were left was an emergency procedure, and it was not the hospital's practice to count instruments, the lawyer said. Can you breathe thick smoke? Model trains and things can get down this New Mexico chimney, and I hope you and what you have can, because I know that it must work. Mindy is in her room, and in the refrigerator are batteries and film, but there is milk and a few shrimp and sauce.
Thank you. That is a long piece. I appreciate you reading it. And I imagine it's quite tricky to read.
It is. And I deliberately put in some syntax issues and problems so that just to kind of reflect where my writing would have been at the time. I was late to writing, definitely late to even reading. And so my letters were probably very choppy. So there's a couple of stumbles in that piece. But a lot of them are deliberate, where the verb agreement isn't quite on, and that was a deliberate act. So Gussie Papoma is straight up nonfiction. It's also memoir. It's also embellishment on one angle because it is a metamorphosis of me writing these letters of want, wherein I then find myself that that was actually part of this capitalistic problem from the inside in the first place.
Yes, and that the clash, I mean, it's quite extraordinary. I wanted you to read it because you really hear it out loud, the clash between these two different voices, this kind of innocent but hungry voice of the child, and then this kind of absolutely sophisticated, but also completely, lacking in emotion, but also kind of gross voice of the, of the medical profession. And this fascinating clash and the ominous thread that ties them together as well.
It is pretty gross, and I was fascinated by that particular case where the gentleman had two clamps left in him, not one but two, and it took two additional operations within years later to finally get them out. So having something left in me, because I've had major operations and not too far in the past, and it kind of gives me the willies a bit to think that something, you know, some tweezers or gauze might still be in there. Yeah.
Yeah,
I
that
don't think
comes.
so. At least I have.
It's great though, because it really makes the reader, feel all these different cognitive dissonances at once. And then, and there's something that comes out of that, and maybe some kind of, way of making
Maybe
sense.
it'll make people squirm or gross out, and that's fine. That's all intended if that's what
That's all good,
happens.
yes. Yeah. So, talk to me about the reverse ekphrasis of California. How do words subvert semantics in this section?
But that's an interesting piece. I wanted to basically those poems are in response to historical photographs that don't exist, but they very well could have existed. So I did a lot of research about California history, pop culture, marketing, history of the railroads, mining history, and just to get a sense of kind of what sort of images were in those kind of archives and museums. And from there, I started crafting pieces to tell a small historical tidbit of California history, but just not necessarily using erasure, but just distilling it down to just sharp little elements, filaments of words. So I kind of wanted to unlock the chemistry of words. When you put two particular words together, very specifically, what can that mean? And so a reader reading them, it's a pretty big leap to kind of reverse engineer the history that they're reflecting, although there's clues everywhere. And that's okay. So that was more of just an exercise in trying to do that. Whether it's successful or not, I'm not sure, but I do really like that section.
I think so. I said in my review, which you can read after, that it almost feels like kind of the Beatles' "I Am the Walrus" and the rhythms. There's like it feels like it's actually resolving to something, but it isn't. You've got words that work together kind of rhythmically and create kind of a meaning that can't resolve to a picture.
I mean, there's one of the pieces is about the rapper Ice-T, who I guess most people of our vintage probably would have heard. And I was kind of researching his history in high school in Compton or somewhere in Los Angeles. And so that was a pretty fun piece. That was a very specific one. But I don't think, unless you are like a top 1,000 fan of this famous artist, I'm not sure that a general reader would be able to reverse engineer, but that's who it's about. And that's okay. I'm not trying to fool or trick anybody or obfuscate. But that was a general source. It was a bit of fun to work with.
Yeah,
There's
and
another one. Oh,
yeah,
go
no, I
ahead.
was just going to say that these kind of fake ekphrasis or reverse, let's call them reverse. It's an interesting contrast with case study, which is really comes across with a lot of verisimilitude and also a little bit of grossness, but also really fun kind of business case. And then coming in as a reader of poetry. To read this incredibly prosaic piece. I'm not going to give anything away about this one because I do think it's really fun what it resolves to. I don't think it hurts it, but I still think it's fun to, the denouement is
Case
fun.
study. Case study was written at the very depths of COVID, but it reflects my first professional career as a financial superannuation accountant, which I did 1997, 8, and 9. So that career didn't last long. But I mean, I remember reading, when you read business and investor literature, as it were, and media, it is uniquely cold in its own way and absolutely shameless in its pursuit of wealth and wealth creation. And so I was exposed to a lot of that and I've never really forgotten it. And I wanted to try to write a biting satire using that tone, which is also pretty cold and unfeeling, but to include in it some really outlandish things that happen. So that's a piece that very well could have been written, but we'll see. I won't really give it away. So.
No, and I won't give anything away either. Although I'd love to see it in the Harvard Business Review.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'll take that publication.
That's right. That's right. All right. Look, unfortunately, we're running out of time, so I'm not going to get you to read anything more. But just a final question. I know Fat Chance hasn't been out very long, but have you got something in the pipeline? Is it, do you feel like there's more material in here that you want to keep working with? I mean, it almost feels like there's a link between the early poems in California Suite, and the poems in Sputnik's Cousin, and this. It almost feels like there's another one that could build on this in some way.
Potentially, like the short answer is no, I haven't started anything new. And the poems in Fat Chance have been accumulating over a number of years. But once I was getting into the exercise of trying to write in the tones that I was, which is new for me, it really I'm really interested to write more along those lines. So that's about the most I could actually say, but no, I'm not actually creating anything new. I'll let this book have its time in the micro sunlight for a couple of years. There's not some massive demand for Kent McCarter poetry books out there, so we'll see where
Well,
this one goes. I'll be reading from it at the Brisbane Writers Festival soon,
oh, brilliant.
and
I'll put a link
maybe
to
some people.
that.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and to your website and to the books page. That's all we have time for today. But Kent, thank you so much for joining me again. It was great to talk to you. Love the book. It's really unique. And bye for now.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on again, Magdalene. I really appreciate it.